Argument is United States versus Moore. Mr. Walrath.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Jim Walrath. I appear here for the appellant defendant, Raymel Moore. I'd like to begin with what I think is an applicable hypothetical. Suppose a meeting was held of state and federal prosecutors in which they agreed to divide up prosecutions of several persons who were involved, according to investigators, in the same drug conspiracy. They decide who is to be subjected to prosecution under less harsh state sentencing schemes versus more harsh federal schemes by throwing the names of all the conspirators into a hat. And then they decide who, in essence, is going to be subject to the harsher mandatory minimum federal sentencing scheme based upon which name is drawn out of the hat.
I have to tell you, I don't see any problem with that.
Well, that, it seems to me,
right. Because that would, I mean, the hat thing is a little silly, but suppose federal, let me finish, would you please? Suppose the federal and state people get together and they say, look, we, the state, we have certain resources we can devote to this case, but we're limited. We'd like you to take some of these guys. And the federal says, yeah, we can take one or two. And the state says, do you care which? Said, no, they're all the same. So they divide them up, you know, arbitrarily. Right? That's the essence of your... That's your example, yeah, right? Nothing wrong with that.
No, because, Your Honor...
What's wrong with that?
You've added an ingredient, state... The limitation on state resources.
Well, obviously, both the states and the federal government have resource limitations, and when they're overlapping state and federal crimes, they're dividing this up all the way. You know, drug cases can be prosecuted either way, bank robbery and so on.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I submit.
Do you think the federal courts are going to go into the go into these meetings and tell the state and federal prosecutors how to divide up these dual state-federal violation cases? That's ridiculous.
I expect that the federal courts, when raised by the defense, the question of what was any factor
who
that
cares? As long as it's not invidious, you know, it's race or First Amendment or something like that, who cares on what basis they divide up? If you have a person who has the misfortune to violate federal and state crimes at the same time, federal usually more severely prosecuted, then it's just, it's random whether he's going to be hit with a federal prosecution.
I would equate randomness.
It's like coming before a strict judge or a lenient judge, right?
Your Honor, I would equate the randomness.
Look, what the Supreme Court has now done with sentencing, it's reintroduced a very large measure of discretion by district judges. That means the luck of the draw will often determine how severe a sentence a person gets. You're not going to say that's unconstitutional.
I am, because that's
arbitrary. Well, you can't, because that's the Booker case. Supreme Court just decided that. And Kimbrough, they keep expanding discretion of district judges. And every time they expand discretion, they're saying, look, your sentence may depend on which judge you get in this purely random assignment of judges, right?
Except, Your Honor, I'm not challenging a decision here as to what sentencing scheme the defendant faced, because that wasn't a judicial decision. That was a prosecutorial decision. But my point is, you're talking about randomness.
I gave you an example of judicial discretion, sentencing discretion, that leads to disparities in sentencing based on who the judge is, and the judge is chosen randomly. And that's exactly the kind of injustice that you're complaining about. But the Supreme Court thinks the alternative of rules that require uniform sentencing is worse.
Your Honor, I think your example does not apply simply because the federal sentencing scheme nonetheless requires under the guidelines or there must be an explanation.
Hey, where
of
have
the
you
court's
been the last
thinking.
Few years? Look, after Booker, look, the judge has to give reasons, but he has great discretion because of the vagueness of the statutory factors. And that means, I'm sure you advise your clients that once you know who the judge is, you know whether you're likely to get a heavier sentence or a lighter sentence, right?
But the situation here was that the only factor that led to Raymel Moore walking into a federal court as opposed to a state court with a completely different sentencing scheme was not, first of all, it wasn't a judicial decision, and our point is it really wasn't even a prosecutorial decision. It wasn't even an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. It was the investigative agency's, one investigative agency who had looked into this factual scheme situation decided to go to state court, and a large number, 17 people, were prosecuted as being conspirators involved with Mr. Moore in the same conduct. They went into state court. That was a decision not made by prosecutors.
Who cares who made the decision?
Because that's a definition of arbitrary. That it, and, Your Honor, to claim or to suggest that only invidious discrimination can be brought under the equal protection
but
argument.
That's precisely what
that,
the Supreme Court.
That is not the standard under
Supreme
Village of
Court has held that prosecutorial discretion is unreviewable unless it's invidious.
Or arbitrary.
United no, States unless it's Chapman. Invidious.
United States versus Chapman, Your Honor, my time is up.
Thank you very much. So, Ms. Watzke?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Watzke, and I represent the United States in this matter. We're really only here for one reason, and that is that Mr. Moore is unhappy with the fact that he got charged in federal court as opposed to state court, and as a result, he was subject to these mandatory minimum penalties, penalties which he agreed applied to him when he decided to plead guilty to conspiring to distribute more than 50 grams of crack cocaine. And we're hearing now for the first time on appeal this constitutional challenge. It was not raised before the district court. So from the government's perspective, these claims are waived because they weren't raised in any sort of pretrial motion alleging vindictive or selective prosecution. There was a plea agreement in which the defendant admitted all of the relevant
conduct. Suppose the selection, take the example they gave, but let's suppose it was a personal animus. It wasn't a constitutional violation like something based on race or religion or freedom of speech, but it was personal animus because this person had cheated him at cards many times in the past or something. He just hated his guts, so he wanted to put him into federal court instead of state court. Would that be permissible or not?
Well, that may form the basis, I suppose, Your Honor, for some sort of, you know, improper prosecutorial misconduct. I suppose it would depend on the facts. But I don't think so, Judge. I mean, I think, frankly, Judge Posner is right. The limitations on prosecutorial or charging discretion are, you know, race or religion or sex or some other constitutionally impermissible
basis. Personal animus doesn't count.
I don't think so, Judge. I mean, I certainly wouldn't advocate for that kind of charging decision, but I'm not sure that would count under these circumstances. You know, the problem with Mr. Walrath's hypothetical here is that, first of all, there's a couple of problems. But first of all, it presupposes that there was a meeting between federal and state prosecutors.
Well, of course, he started out to make it purely random, which is the opposite of what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting
you're right.
Quite unrandom.
You're right, Judge. And there was no such agreement here. My office had absolutely no involvement in the Milwaukee County District Attorney's decision to prosecute these 17 other individuals, one of whom was Mr. Moore's co-defendant, Curtis Jones. There were separate law enforcement agencies involved, and it just so happened that the agency that referred Mr. Moore and Mr. Jones to my office had hoped to build a larger case against these two individuals, and that just didn't come to fruition. And so they recommended that we charge these two discrete controlled buys and a conspiracy between them. And that's what happened. And our charge occurred in January, I believe, of 2007. The state's charges occurred much earlier in May of 2006. And when the state prosecutor learned that we had sought a federal indictment, the charges against Mr. Jones were dismissed. There's really no evidence. And actually, judges, Your Honors, I should correct just at the outset. There is an error in the government's brief in this case, which was written by my colleague, Michelle Jacobs. She argues that there's absolutely, you know, the record's completely devoid of any information about these other 17 individuals other than Mr. Jones. And that's not correct, and I apologize to the court for that error. The record in the matter was enlarged following the sentencing, and Mr. Walraff submitted the state criminal complaint and some summary information about some of the sentences that were received in the state prosecution. And so, again, I apologize to the court for that error. But even if we consider that supplemental information, there's just not enough there for us to confidently conclude that those other individuals are so similarly situated to Mr. Moore, such that, you know, he is now in a class of one because he's been federally prosecuted. We don't know anything about their criminal histories. We don't know whether they were cooperating with the government. We don't know the nature or the strength of the evidence against any of those folks. What we do know is that the one person who was most similarly situated to Mr. Moore was Mr. Jones. Those were the only two individuals referenced in the state case who were involved in a controlled buy of a substantial quantity of crack cocaine, and those were the two individuals who got charged federally, and those were the two individuals who pled guilty to the same count and ultimately both received a mandatory minimum of 10 years imprisonment. And so, you know, minimally, the record establishes that Mr. Moore was in a class of two, and so there's just no basis for concluding an equal protection violation here. Similarly, there's just no basis for concluding a due process violation here. You know, Judge Posner is right. The arbitrariness, I mean, I think Mr. Walrath takes issue with my colleague Brian Ressler's comments at sentencing that the federal prosecution stemmed from law enforcement's efforts to clean up an investigation that didn't develop into what they thought it would. I think he suggests that the term cleanup, you know, means that this decision was very cavalier or arbitrary, but I don't agree with that characterization. But even if I did, for the sake of argument, that's not enough here. That's not enough to establish a constitutional due process violation. And there is absolutely, there's just no hint of anything in the record which suggests a constitutionally impermissible motive in the charging decision. And I think the defendant concedes as much in his brief. So on this record, Mr. Moore falls far short of establishing either a due process or an equal protection violation, and for that reason, I ask the court to affirm.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wodsky. Mr. Walrath, your time expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
As to the proposition that there must be a racial animus or some other form of invidious discrimination, the class of one ruling in Village of Willowbrook seems to me is now the law. For a class of one equal protection claim, if you show arbitrariness, you do not have to show one of these other forms or accompany that with a showing of invidious discrimination. That's one point I would like to raise. The other point I would like to raise is this court's decision, and I'll not pronounce it correctly, I fear, in Sichon, the City of Chicago, cited at footnote 19 of my brief, page 16, gives guidance where you have two similarly situated employees of the City of Chicago, one who is subjected to discipline and one who is not. When they are similarly situated, this court says that is a form of that where there is no rational basis, then it is arbitrary. And I submit on the record of this case, that is the situation facing Raymel Moore. No rational basis, therefore it was arbitrary. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Walrath. And you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the client. We thank Ms. Wodsky, too. And our last case.